Check when it's, once they run out of fuel, momentum motors to, move the satellites one way or the other if they need to in space, but especially their fuel does get exhausted. Wouldn't it be nice to just go up there and refuel them when we drop it? Bringing already, $400 million satellites and putting them up, send up a, maybe $100 million flight, and they could save a lot of money. So they're working on it, that guy. And that's just done a couple of weeks ago. All done and successfully. 100% been in Mesquite, all from the ground. Duplicating or refueling mission using the International Space Station as a test bed. Back in it.
That's exciting stuff, Paul. But I see a problem. We put a huge number of dollars into a piece of hardware that you put in geosynchronous orbit. And you'd like to be able to use a geosynchronous satellite as a repeater for 10 years, 15 years, if you can stretch it that far. And during that time, you're continuously using up your consumable fuel, which allows you to stay on station. Let me drop. By on station, I mean, by Intelsat agreement, you have to keep your particular satellite that's in that one-dimensional real estate. Geosynchronous orbit is a string of beads directly over the equator, a perfectly circular orbit directly over the equator. That's why I'm calling it one direction, one-dimensional real estate. It has nothing but the longitude. You know the latitude is zero. You know the altitude is 22,300 miles. Okay. To go up there and refuel the satellites, because they're running out of consumables, and when they do, you have to blast them to a higher orbit, because that's where the grade is. And you've already spent all the money to put that hardware there. You'd like to continue to use it when it runs low on fuel. And so you and I can envision going up there, refueling them, and bringing it back down, putting no fuel into the vehicle, and sending it back up again. No way. You know how big the rocket is on the ground that allows you to get off the Earth into the parking orbit, and then you use the Apogee kick motor and a whole bunch of other motors to make the orbit circular and get you up to synchronous orbit. You know how big that rocket was when it was sitting on the ground. Once that piece of hardware, whether it be the repair hardware or the satellite itself, once something's in synchronous orbit, if you decide you want to bring it back to Earth, you need a booster. You need a booster that's equally as big, with a little bit less, because you can use some of the atmosphere as a braking, but you need almost as big a booster to bring it back and send it there in the first place. You don't have that capability. So, all of these refueling missions, as I see it, Paul, are one-way missions. You build a piece of hardware, you put as much fuel as you can on board, you fly them up to synchronous orbit, and then you refuel as many satellites as you can. After that, that piece of hardware has to be sent higher orbit into the graveyard, because you haven't got the capability to bring it all the way back down. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I see it, Paul. WS2N, KQLIW, in the TechNet.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything about these robots coming back. For instance, Cedrus, I think was $400 million. If I'm not mistaken, I'll have to go back. I just read it a month or so ago. But let's call it $400 million. Now, if you could build a robotic satellite to get up there with fuel in it, some hydrogen fuel, the only thing you want to do is refuel this thing and maybe, do a couple of other things, work with some thermal blankets. I did read that this had the capability of doing that. They did that as well on the test mission. Sometimes the thermal blankets need to be redone or moved, or maybe it wasn't right during takeoff. You want to adjust something. So now you take this, $50 million robot, put fuel in it. Essentially, an expensive wrench. And go off to this $400 million and repair it. And then toss the robotic satellite, just make new ones for future repair. And, you know, put those into the graveyard. And, you know, it's a lot cheaper to put up a, let's say, a $50 million robot repair mission instead of another $400 million satellite being built by Boeing, in this case, the Aegis satellite. Back to you there.
Okay, so you're saying the repair mission is considerably cheaper than the original piece of hardware. I agree with you. And when it comes to the repair missions of the future, if you Google the word Dean Kamen, Dean Kamen is the guy who invented the concept of the first composition, FIRST, where for the last 15 years or so, your various high schools, progressive high schools across the United States, will compete with each other with these robot-like devices. And it's a very educational process for the students. My son was involved in supporting a local high school during one of those design and development operations for the robot of that particular school in Iceland. And so when you Google the word Dean Kamen and you see the work that Dean is working on these days, where one of his hobbies is to design hardware for disabled soldiers. And I'm talking about hands, arms, feet, legs. And he has made working models these days of an object that's like a hand. It's got five fingers, it's got a wrist, it's got an arm. And except for the fact that it's mechanical, it looks extremely similar to a human hand. It doesn't have flesh on it, but it has essentially all the same maneuverability, dexterity, can pick up glasses, can maneuver things, can write. And so he's installing these things as limb replacements for soldiers that have had some terrible war-caused disabilities. If you have Dean Kamen design the adaptive object that's on a repair mission, I'm beginning to think that what we did at Hubble with human beings, I think it's not going to be too many years from now when a robot can do that. And you and I would be willing to send a robot. Let me drop this. You and I would be willing to send a robot on a one-way mission to a geosynchronous orbit. Because, with rare exception, anything that mankind ever puts into geosynchronous orbit will never come back to this planet. It's gone forever. Because you haven't got that same size booster to bring it back. We all remember that one of the missions of Hubble took a geosynchronous satellite that only went up to parking orbit. The Apogee kick motor failed. And in one case, they replaced the Apogee kick motor and then sent it on its way. In another case, they put it in the cargo hold and brought it back home, the satellite, from parking orbit. By current standards, I now know that that was a slightly risky mission because you put all that extra mass in the cargo hold. That means that when you enter the Earth's atmosphere, you've got to decelerate not only the shuttle itself, but all the extra mass you put into the cargo hold. That means the total amount of heating of the tiles on the leading edge of that wing has to take all of that extra energy you're dissipating. So that puts extra risk on that mission as I see it. So I can see why, for a whole bunch of reasons, they didn't do very many rescues and bring back home. So these robot missions to geosynchronous orbit to do repair and or refueling, as I see it, they're one-way missions. And I'm willing to make this very elaborate robot and send it on a one-way mission. We're certainly not willing to do that with a human being. Over to you for any further comments on this, Paul. I wonder if you've seen any of these YouTube videos on Dean Kamen. Some of them are very educational. WS2N, K2LIW, on the TechNet.
No, I haven't seen the YouTube ones that you talked about now. But they're thinking about the... Yeah, that was back in the 80s when they were going out and grabbing satellites that was effective. I think the one they brought back was an Indian satellite built for India. That was defective, and they wanted to bring it back and send it back up. That was the one that was Bruce McCandless went out. He had a backpack on. You see a lot of TV shows and commercials and stuff. They'll always do that. As, you know, it's pretty impressive. He's flying free. No limbs, and bulletproof whatsoever. Has this man maneuvering unit on, attached to his body. I mean, it's not just his back. He's like sitting in this thing practically. And he flies away from the shuttle, and he grabs a hold of this satellite, and you know, these things are spinning, and they're usually spinning like, you know, maybe once every minute or so. And he grabs a hold of it, and with his backpack, he's trying to slow it down, and of course, that's about to create a wobble. Backed away from it, and they thought about it for a while, and he got a hold of it again, and finally did manage to slow down and stop it from spinning. And then slowly they worked it to get it into the cargo bay, and they finally attached it, you know, and people out there with a spacewalk, and they finally attached it to the shuttle, and they did bring it back. That's probably the one you're thinking about next, back here.
You're absolutely right, Paul. It was a satellite from India. And it probably was, like you said, $400 or $800 million worth of hardware that they brought back home, and they had a chance to fix it and send it back up again, which saves them a whole lot of time and money of developing another satellite. And from parking orbit, you can do that. And anything above parking orbit, you can't go there. And you have to be willing to put the shuttle into the exact same orbital inclination and altitude as the satellite. So if your only mission is just to do a capture of a satellite and bring it back home, no problem. If you're going to make it a dual mission, well, I'm going to hop up there and go to the International Space Station, and then I'll hop over to the satellite and recover it. On paper, that sounds good. You can't do that. The amount of fuel it takes to change the inclination of orbit is huge. I mean, if that satellite is in some other orbit inclination different than the International Space Station, you can't go there. If it's at a different altitude and the exact same plane of orbit, maybe. But I vaguely remember that it is so inefficient to change the plane of orbit that if you use up every bit of the fuel you've got on the shuttle after you put it into orbit, I think you can only tilt the plane of orbit by something like 3 degrees, and you burned up all the fuel doing that. One of the puzzles that I've used with the guys that I work with is what happens if you launch a satellite that's polar, and you found out, well, somebody goofed, it should have been in equatorial orbit. So you think, well, I just make a right-hand turn and convert the polar orbit into a equatorial orbit. And the question I ask people is, okay, it took 1 unit of booster power to get it into polar orbit. How many units of booster power is going to take it from flipping from a polar orbit to an equatorial orbit? A 90-degree turn, so to speak. On the Earth, where the wheels can push against the ground and you turn the steering wheel, that's easy. In space, you've got nothing to push against. Every bit of that's going to be rocket power. Let me drop. The surprising answer is, if it took you 1 unit of booster power to get it into equatorial orbit, it takes you 2 units of booster power to convert that polar orbit into an equatorial orbit. Because in that polar orbit, every bit of your velocity is in the wrong plane. You could say, simplistically, you have to stop all of your polar velocity, make it go to zero, over the equator, then reestablish the equatorial velocity. You can see it takes 2 units of booster energy to do that. The bottom line is, if you launched a satellite into polar orbit by mistake, do not bring it back. Do not steer it to a new orbit. sell it to somebody, build a brand new one, and launch it into equatorial orbit to come out way ahead. The bottom line of that is changing orbital plane, very, very difficult. So these repair missions, if you're doing nothing but the repair mission, that's easy. But if you think the repair mission is going to be tacked down to some other mission, it's almost impossible. But I see the possibility of robots. In fact, my wife is teaching at Suffolk Community College, and some of her students are extremely enthralled by robots of various kinds. So as we build better and better mechanical robot-like things that are going to look eventually very man-like, they're going to have a real hand, a real wrist, a real arm, a real elbow, a real shoulder, real knee, real ankle, and so on. You're going to literally duplicate a human being with servo motors. And so that's the right way to do the repair. Any final words on any of the on this, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, my grandkids eventually. I mean, they're only little kids now. But when they get old, they go to Carnegie Mellon. Tell my daughter. Hey, you know, that's the way to go. Robotics. They're big on that. I think MIT is good. Caltech. They're all these. That's the future. There is a robot that kind of looks like a person. Yes. Arms, shoulders, not that size. Well, I was describing before that's on the opposite side of the basic, that's called Dexter. That's a big acronym. But basically a big robot that can move around on the space station. I mean, big, you know, like 20 feet high. Doesn't look like a human. It does kind of got a shoulder, kind of like a torso. That's about it. The one that I'm talking about, let me drop it, was put up on the space station. I think it was the second or third last flight of the space shuttle. They brought this robot up. I forgot the name of it. Bobby 2, I don't know. It was built by General Motors. They're the ones that put it together. And it's what you're describing, your wife described, with the hand and the motion and the ability to do fine work, which, you know, head and shoulders, you know, eyes. A lot of people think it's the main computer, of course, in the head, it's not, it's in the body. And it doesn't have any feet, but they could attach feet to it if they wanted to. They could put legs on the torso and stuff. And right now it's inside the space station. And it stayed there probably 5-6 months before they started working with it. And they've done some work with it, and they're seeing how it does inside. And eventually, someday, if it works out, they like where everything goes, they're thinking about putting one, maybe not that one, but another one on the outside of the space station to do some fine work that a man could do. And takes a lot of risk out of things that they're doing. The idea that, you know, you could eventually do that would really pay off. You might save somebody's life somewhere down the road. It was a difficult job that a robot could do. Just good. Back to you.
Yeah, there's another interesting way of looking at this whole situation. Let's assume now that you and I reach out my hand, pick up a glass, bring it to my mouth, and drink. What's really happening there? The brain is talking to a bunch of nerves. The nerves go down my shoulder, through my elbow, across the wrist, into the hand, and the hand is being ordered to grab that glass, and the eye is watching what's going on. So that communication path, that servo mechanism between my brain and that hand, is roughly 3 feet long. If you've got a good enough television camera, a good enough servo mechanism, and a good enough communication network, that hand could be 10,000 miles away. Except for a little bit of time delay at the speed of light, you wouldn't know the difference. So you and I could be sitting in a booth manipulating something that you plug your hand in. And the real hand 10,000 miles away in space doing the operation. As long as the servo mechanism is... communication path...
Bernie@huntfamily.com, and so the hypophysics site will show you this very
nice picture. It's an isometric picture of what does a radio wave look like in space if you had the ability to see the E field and the B field. That's echo field and Bravo field. Echo is the voltage field and Bravo is the magnetics. So I know that you and I were having a bit of a discussion last week about whether or not the E and the B are in time synchronization, but spatial quadrature. And I believe you were saying that there's a misinterpretation going on, that really a time quadrature is required. You might want to say a couple of words on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, KQLIW.
Try it again one more time, please, WS Glenn.
Paul, I'm not quite sure what you said. Paul, are you saying that, the website you have to go to get the website. All you have to do is Google hyperphysics and electromagnetic wave. But if you want to get at the direct approach, it is Bernie@HuntFamily.com. Bernie@HuntFamily.com. Bernie K2 Yankee Oscar has established this website a couple of months ago. Whenever we're talking about these secret websites, so to speak, they're all listed there. So now you can all get on the same page. Is that the question you were asking, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Okay, QS, yeah, that's what I wanted to know. Very good, thank you, sir.
Okay, so once again, Glenn, I was hearing you very well 60 seconds ago. And so did that hyperphysics diagram seem to fit the model in your head as to what the RF wave in free space really looks like? Because the verbal description you and I had last week seemed to be slightly different from each other. KC2QIQ, KQLIW. Even if you're not coming through the machine, I hear you very well on the input, therefore I'll repeat whatever you say. And it looks like our fella is getting more enthusiastic, and he's making life difficult for us, Glenn. That's what I think you're saying, and I believe you're right. Sad state of affairs here that we've got a person that disgruntled in the New York City area, that he takes something that, after 30 years, a significant number of people have quite a bit of appreciation for something called Limonk and Technical Med, and he gets pleasure out of making their life miserable. He's a sad individual. He's not going to be doing this very much longer. That's what it says here. Make another attempt, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. My guess is, Glenn, you don't have the ability to go to the Sheldon input, and you might not have 450 by which you can go to Limonk's 449-125 machine. If we go to 449-12225, we hear you beautifully. Wonder if you have the ability to do that, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. I just heard somebody call my name. Oh, is that you, Joe? Go ahead. To answer your question, Joe, various things are being turned on and off as a countermeasure. And Glenn, I'm hearing you weekly. I'm not sure now, are you coming through the Eastern input or 449-125? I think the 449-125 might be the best one if you have that ability, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is Sheldon right now.
Yeah, Sheldon to the west is a little bit lower than I'd like on sensitivity. So give it a try. In other words, when you're coming through Sheldon, you're 60%. 20% audio, 40% noise. A little bit unpleasant. We could do it if we have no choice. Try 449-125. Oh, you're gone.
The Rose Robert 67, I have an antenna for that right now. That's the, unless I go to the mobile, but I prefer that to be on the phone for me.
Okay, I heard you say you don't have an antenna for that one. Okay, I'll have to go over to your house and install a 440 antenna for you. That's a joke. As you know, for a ridiculous length of time, I didn't have a cable going to my rotator on top of a 100-foot tower. I couldn't rotate that particular Yagi unless the people were threatening to come over and install that cable for me. Well, no longer do they have to do that. Bunch of complicated reasons as to why. Okay, so right now I think you're saying that from your home, the best you've got is the eastern input. And does that antenna have any aiming capability? Is there a rotator on that one, or is that a fixed vertical antenna? KCQQIQ, K2LIW.
So it's just a vertical antenna tonight, Dick. That's what the problem is. And, as far as the UHF right now,
very fine, Glenn. I heard all of that. I presume now on the Sheldon frequency, you're using the best antenna, you're using the best amplifier, and the system is flat out. Is that true, Glenn? In other words, you have no more watts left over. You can't breathe real heavy on that final amplifier and get a few more watts out of it. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, having some fun with you.
Two problems, Dick. I got plenty of power over here, about the altitude to right now I'm only maybe 20 feet, so it's just not that exciting. So I'll take this up another night. We can hold for another week, I guess, and maybe by that time I'll have a good kind of setup or something else we do, maybe in the mobile. Okay, Dick, have a good evening. K2IW, K2IW, K2IW.
Glad that last transmission was 95% copy. Give me a couple of sentences on your impression of that hyperphysics diagram, if you had a chance to see it. And maybe you did, because I sent it to you awful late today. But does that diagram, for understanding of what a free space RF wave would look like, or is it a bit different than your understanding? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
There's two real problems with this. One is that, yes, that is what the electromagnetic wave looks like, but that particular representation seems to be something very specific. It's very specific in that it's a description of the electromagnetic wave being measured in a single path length, meaning a wave length that's in resonance. That resonance is being a continuous wave signal. Changes and
some restoration is required, so I have no applet capability. So therefore I couldn't find a good one. But to my knowledge, that was a free space wave. That wasn't just one wavelength or one and a half wavelengths. That was a particular chunk of volume of space being analyzed at one snapshot in time. Snapshot in time. And the B or the E really is a continuous sine wave. If you allowed time to progress forward, you would watch that wave continuously going up and down in E and back and forth in B, and continuously propagating to the Z axis. So I don't think that was just one particular wavelength. It was just a snapshot of you're transmitting a billion waves, and we decided to look at one of them at a snapshot in time. And maybe I shouldn't force you to, under this condition, maybe I should let you go, Glenn. And thank you for the attempt. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
In a very good dish. It is one, and it's representing a continuous wave. The reason why the H field and the E field are established in that particular instance is because when you're measuring with an antenna, the H field in free space will diminish very, very rapidly. And what's happening is that there is a phase shift between D and H in free space. So when it's measured, when you're taking an antenna measurement at some distance, then what happens is it's resonant. And when you're measuring with an antenna, you will measure the H field
it in a way that's traceable to the Bureau, then I see no reason why the antenna measuring volts per meter, and if you use a different kind of a sensing device and you measure B in amps per meter, as long as your instrumentation is traceable to the Bureau, whether I use brand A, B, or C of sensing antenna, or method D, E, and F of E or B sensing, that shouldn't be part of the equation. You're saying it, the resonance of the antenna is making that happen. I say the resonance of the antenna is part of its process by which it radiates or receives, and once you go through the procedure of calibrating that in a way traceable to the Bureau, the antenna itself is not the measurement. It's what's in free space is the measurement. That's my feeling on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2IW.
Okay, that's your feeling, but tonight I think I'm going to introduce you to something new. That's true only in the antenna, and it's exclusive to the antenna. And I have many, many things in which I can prove it to you. What's happening is, like you said before, resonance in an antenna is a very difficult thing to do. And when you're making a measurement in free space, the E field is dominant, and the resonance of the antenna is what's completing. Because remember, when you're looking at a wavelength on an antenna, you're not looking at a full wavelength. You're looking at a fraction of a wavelength, and the antenna has resonance. Seeing now the E and the H field at the antenna, what's leading the H field around that wavelength is resonance. So when you attach to an E field, the resonance in continuous waves, the energy around E will keep on propagating through the antenna until the H field is established. Proportional, E field and H field are proportional in the antenna. But in free space, it is truly different. But first, I want you to understand that yes, the antenna has resonance. Now, if you have a device that is non-resonant and you're only hearing one signal, the H field is extremely diminished in free space. Resonance to be established. That's the most important part you'd understand. And when you're looking at H fields and how they're represented, the antenna that's reestablishing that field. I might have to send you a few other documents, but so you can understand the difference that I'm making right now, that's between free space and what the antenna is actually doing and what resonance is really doing for you. K2IW, K2QIQ.
Okay. Yeah, I think I see what you're saying, which is causing me to ask this particular question. If I use antenna A, which happens to have a Q of 10, and it's a half wavelength sensing device, and I calibrate it, and now I make a measurement of what I think is E in volts per meter, and what I think is B in amps per meter. And then I go over to a second antenna, which is not a half wavelength. It happens to be 1.5 wavelengths, but I've calibrated it, traceable to the Bureau, and I make a measurement of E and B on the second antenna, which has a different Q, a different physical size, but I properly calibrate it, and once I use the calibration factors of the two antennas, will the E and B that I measure in antenna A, and after I use the cal factors, will the E and B that I measure in antenna B, which is very different, will I get different E and Bs that are different? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Actually, I think you already know the answer to this. And that, as you said, it's all in calibration. And as long as you understand what you're doing, that the impedance of the antennas and the path length of the radiation receptor will be different. So as far as the volts per square meter or the E field at the radiating element will be different. But as long as you're smart enough and realize that when you're doing the conversion, whether you're starting with a quarter of an element, a quarter of an element, a quarter of an element, the conversion, make sure that those calibrated to the same. Yes, that is the calibrator, and when it's
you're telling me that I get different answers with different antennas. I would assume that when I'm trying to measure a free space wave and I want to quantify its magnitude of Echo and Bravo, that it should be independent of my instrumentation, as long as my instrumentation is properly calibrated. In one case, I could be using a parabolic dish with a feed horn that's extremely broadband. I could be using a locked periodic antenna that's many decades broad. Or I could use a very narrow band Yagi antenna or a dipole antenna. All three of those antenna types, with proper calibration, are going to come up with the exact same answer for Echo and Bravo in my mind. I think you're telling me that what is really there in free space, that the Echo and the Bravo of the wave as it's taught to us by the classes we've taken, you're saying that the magnitude of the Echo and the Bravo in free space truly changes as a function of what antenna I use to measure it. And that's a tough one for me to swallow. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
No, I have to say it again, that's not, absolutely not what I said. Not at all. They're always, when they're calibrated, they must be the same. You follow that so far?
You did say that when they're properly calibrated, the measurements must be the same. So far we're starting to sound like we're on the same page. Back to you, Glenn, for what you think is the difference.
RW, does he have UHF capability at his house?
About a single path length, are you talking about the E direction, the B direction or the zebra direction. The zebra direction on that diagram showed 1.5 waves. And if I went 1,000,000 waves downrange, I believe they would be lockstep identical in E, B, and Z. So when you say one path length, when every path length and a zillion of them is identical, I'm a little confused by that one. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
When you're looking at the diagram, the multiple waves is called T. The base, the path length of the measurement is the length of which it's being measured. Okay, so it's the optical, how it's being viewed. Okay, so the multiple wavelength is just delta T, and the viewpoint is one path length. Now, when a continuous wave is in free space, there are many path lengths. There is not just the measurement point, there's all the path lengths taking place from the radio source all the way to the reception antenna. It's following that there are many, many paths of the waves before it reaches the reception antenna, and at the reception antenna, there is only a singular around the antenna, only separated by time.
Okay, for me to restate those words, you say there's multiple path lengths, multiple path waves, so to speak. If my test is being done in a purely anechoic chamber, where there is nothing but the free space, direct wave, and all bounces off the walls and ceilings, everything else has all been absorbed. If I have this theoretical perfect chamber, a Marchionne natal chamber, which is a zillion wavelengths long, it's perfectly anechoic, and in that diagram, I'm looking at wave number 1 billion, and I could at a later time look at 1 billion and 1, 1 billion and 2, and if the chamber is big enough and I'm in the far field, I could look downrange, uprange. I'm going to always see the exact same thing, is my belief. And you're saying no. You're saying that those multiple waves combine in a particular way during that measurement. I'm having trouble believing there are multiple waves if I've eliminated all echoes in this perfect anechoic chamber. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Frequency might be, it doesn't really matter much. But what you have to understand is that for every length of T, or time, along the continuous wave, there is going to be a basically at a right angle to that, there will be a closed set of H. Do you follow?
I think that's going to take a repeat to understand what we're saying here. The H field does close. Every one of those lines of H is a continuous loop in the universe. But because I'm so far away from that source, and because that point of closure in a transverse distance is so far away from me, that that closure in that volume that I'm analyzing is academic. The fact that I do or don't know that it closes at infinity, why would that change the magnitude of the E or the magnitude of the Bravo that I measure in that volume? Why wouldn't they still be related by 377 ohms? And why wouldn't they still, in the Z direction, fall off by linear versus distance? If I double the distance from the source, I get exactly half the Bravo, I get exactly half the echo that I measured before. You do or don't agree with that one, Glenn? K2LIW?
Okay, we're getting somewhere now. What's happening is the wavelength that's traveling away from the pupil, because it's been an arrow pointed away from the source towards a reception antenna. As that vector moves across, the continuous wave is separated by T. So if you take the number of wavelengths from T over time, you have a distance from the source to the end object. You follow that?
Okay. Distance, time. If I happen to be a million wavelengths away from the source, and if in this example the wavelength is 1 meter, I know I'm exactly 1 million meters from that source. So if it's a 1 meter wavelength, which happens to be, let me think, is that 100 megacycles? No, 300 megacycles. 300 megacycles is 1 meter. So I'm running at 300 megacycles, the wavelength is 1 meter, I'm 1 million meters away from the source. Therefore, I'm looking at wave number 1 meter, or 1 million of what was emitted. I get the delay of a million wavelengths downrange, and in that diagram, I'm looking at 1 million and 1 million and one. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Right on. Now we're getting someplace. So as you're moving along, that along time, now the thing is, at a right angle to that E field in free space, what's going to happen is you're going to have an H field. And I don't worry about the amplitude just yet, but what you have to understand is that around that maximum E field is going to be a circular wavelength test that's proportional to 377 ohms. That's going to determine the length of that of the H path in free space. You follow that? Let me just be more.
Okay, you're starting to talk about a circular path of, I presume, measuring the H. And I don't have to walk around that whole circular path, which goes way out there to infinity. There's nothing stopping me from using, pick a Hall effect device, which I measure the local magnitude of Bravo, or Hotel, whichever you want to call it, and I put it in units of amps per meter. So I can measure the magnitude of H in that volume I'm analyzing. By using a E field sensor, I can measure the magnitude of E. I don't have to measure the whole circular path. In my instrumentation, I don't have to complete the path. Your Hall effect device that's inside of a clamp-on ammeter, yes, I'll admit, it is in a completely closed path. But there's nothing stopping me from opening those jaws very wide on that clamp-on ammeter, and assuming it's got enough frequency response, I can hold it with proper orientation, and I can measure the H field that your antenna emitted 10 miles away from me. As it gets to my open, highly open jaws clamp-on ammeter, I can measure that H field. My instrumentation doesn't have to close the path to measure it. Out there there in infinity, Mother Nature is closing that path. And the back of my mind tells me that. But I don't have to know that to make that measurement. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Look, a couple of words here. The pathway is not infinite. It's not infinite. It's related to 377 ohms. That's the geometry of the pathway. We know what the length, the wavelength is of an E field because of the frequency. The pathway at any one spatial point in time, the E field, so it would be the E field in amplitude at any one point, divided by the 377 ohms, and then you can do a pi omega and then find out what the actual geometric length of the path is. And they're basically in tune with each other. For each wavelength of the heat field, there's going to be a circular path of H that follows it at a right angle. For every wavelength, there would be a quadratic root of H. And the difference is some proportion to 377. It is not infinite. Now, as far as your measurement, will always be uniform because the device that you're going to use to measure is always going to close at the path length around the E field that is centered. K2IW, K2QIQ.
The way you and I studied E and H, in order to follow the theory as it was given to us, we did do a kind of a line integral around a closed path for the E and the H. And that's the way it was taught to us. However, when the Voyager spacecraft, 123 astronomical units away, is sending that X-band signal down to Goldstone, I know that that H-field path of that emitted wave is being closed out there and in space. But since that signal came from such a long distance away, I could assume that that closure took place at a transverse distance of infinity, and that's good enough. I don't have to do that line integral down at the Goldstone dish in order to measure that H field. I can measure that H field without doing the complete line integral, which is the method by which we were taught to use Maxwell's equation. KC2QIQ,
K2IW. That's correct. You don't have to do it if you basically do back calculate two. So in other words, it's only two E fields, but it only works in continuous waves. That's the problem. See, in other words, when you want to know the true amplitude in free spread of H, you basically have to understand what the distance is, what the length is from the source, and like you said, make sure that there's no reflections in that area, and then determine what it is at that instant in time, and then they will be 90 degrees apart. But when you're measuring in an antenna, there will always be an H will always be in phase. There will be maximum at the same time. But this is only true in the antenna. But geometrically, it could never be in phase in free space. And the real reason for that is just because of the general geometry of it. Because what's happening is for each wavelength of E, you're going to have half length of H. And if you want to get a true representation of what the E field and the field look like, you might use an integral. And then you can basically draw a new diagram. But that's why when you're looking at the integral of progression in free space, because the T is moving in a vector away from the transmission source, and the H field is moving perpendicular to the vector of E, that you'll always have a lead lag situation with E and H in free space. Where when you're measuring with your antenna, the antenna will always reestablish E and H with resonance, and resonance will always bring the two back in line again. H1OW2QIQ.
If I had a pure E-field measuring instrumentation, and as a mental experiment, you and I sort of talked about one last week where I've got a pair of polonium sources on opposite ends of a wooden yardstick. Each of them has a battery, a power supply, and electronics that measures the local charge on the upper polonium source, the lower polonium source, digitizes them, sends them on a fiber optic, and that goes into a fiber optic dual detector, and they get compared. So same token, I can use a Hall effect device, and I can measure pure H. The E I could interpret after calibration into volts per minute. Out of the Hall effect device, I could interpret it after calibration into amps per meter. If I did that separate E field measurement and that separate H field measurement,
which came first, the chicken or the egg? If you have a Hall effect device,